four areas mapped out here to talk about. One of them would be the Department of Economics.
Sure.
Because if you recall, when I came, I had a mission to get a chairperson and also to get the curriculum going and things of that sort.
Right. When did you come?
1963. There were two people in the department at that time. Marvin Christine and Eliyahu Kanofsky. And I was the third one. And then I was here. I chaired the department for 2 years in an acting capacity. And then I was lucky enough to get Barbara Thatcher to come. It came the same time that John Toll came. And then we started, and of course I was also recruiting until, you know, it was 63 to 65. I was recruiting mostly junior people. And then, so that I could cover the department in terms of its mission, in terms of the changes. I mean, is that something that you
That's
would
good.
Want?
Yes.
Okay.
See, this is the kind of thing, let's see, you're the only person thus far that I've interviewed in the Department of Economics.
Yeah, but remember that my role on the campus was, in the beginning, was in the department, but then I had these others, and they may be useful too. So a second area that I have is administration.
Right.
And that is not only on campus, but also SUNY-wide.
Yeah, right.
Things that I was involved in, or in an administrative as well as in a professional capacity.
Good. All right. Well, that's...
As a matter of fact, I just recently refreshed my memory. I have some clippings. There was a front page New York Times story on our opening up a library exchange with the Peking Library. This goes back to 1972 and 73, and as a matter of fact, in 73 I went to China and I brought some of the first books that were being exchanged. So that's just an interesting thing. And I also there was also the exchange with Fudan University. I don't know if you know about that. It's probably still in.
How do you spell it?
F-U-D-A-N.
Fudan.
Which is the best university in Shanghai.
Yes, I see.
And it's a university with which C.N. Yang had contact through his father, and he came from not far from there.
Mm-hmm.
And his sister was working in Shanghai. So those are some of the things. And on the SUNY-wide thing, we had a China committee, which I chaired, and which was instrumental with the help of Frank Yang in getting the chancellor to China early on.
I figured somebody had been involved in that. Those would be interesting things to talk about. Definitely.
So that's a second area, and that's a very extensive area.
Yeah.
Now, there were two other things that may be of importance, and one is faculty development.
Yeah.
The program under the American Historical Association auspices. See, because there were different routes, let's say, for faculty development. That was one route. Then we had our internal development here, without any financing from outside. And then another area which is related to faculty development was the Federated Learning Communities, which I was involved in. So those are the areas that I've mapped out to talk about.
All right. Why don't you start with the first one today, and go as far as you want to go. If you
okay.
Have, or you got time.
I have an hour or so.
Good. All right. Let's go to it. I've got plenty of time.
All right. Now, do you want to ask any? I mean, and you're going to feel free to interrupt me.
I will. Yes. The only person in history that I've interviewed is Semmel. Thus far.
So I'm going to see him, so I'll get some pointers from him.
Okay.
Let me ask you one question. You know, I've forgotten the name of the building that we started in. Which is...
We started in the humanities.
That's the humanities.
Yeah. The old humanities.
Yeah,
that name.
I didn't remember that. I knew that it was that the English department had much of the space there when I came.
My office was there for some time until we moved to the library.
Uh-huh. Shall I just start then?
Yes, you have answered the questions.
Yes, all of those questions.
All right, yeah. Okay, good. You want to talk about, first of all, the library?
No, I want to talk about the department first.
The department, all right. Talk about the department first.
Okay.
Good.
And see, I would take it up the early years of the department beyond the point where Bob LaCashman came in 1965, because it was then that we began to develop a strategy, which may or may not have been continued, but it was interesting that we did discuss it and that there was a general consensus on it.
Right.
It's an interesting notion. So I will start with 63. Should I just start talking then?
Sure.
Because you've got a tape.
I've got it going.
Everything is going.
Yeah.
All right. Now, my first contact with Stony Brook was less than a year after you started here.
That's right.
And it was in the spring of 1963 that I was brought in as a candidate for the Department of Economics and for the chairmanship in an acting role.
This was Stan Ross.
Right. He was the dean, and you were the chief academic officer.
Well, I was...
President.
I was the president without the title.
Right. And I even remember the interview I had with you.
Yeah.
We talked about China.
Uh-huh.
At that time, of course, China was in many people's minds, but very little was known about it. And since it was my research area, it was something that was interesting to discuss.
And I had some family that was involved in China.
Yeah.
Great uncle.
I was offered the position in the spring of 1963, and I must say that I was very excited, so excited that I started to come out right away, even though I wasn't on the payroll, but it was the summer, and we had the problems of relocating, and we had identified a house, but we weren't going to be getting into it until late in September. But in the meantime, I came in the summer and started to work on plans for the next academic year. And there was one explicit mission that I had, and that was to search for an economist with a national reputation and who would be a good person to head up a new department in a new university.
Yeah.
And there were some difficulties because at that time, most people in academia didn't know what Stony Brook was, where it was. They knew nothing about, so that you had to overcome a kind of psychological obstacle. But I figured that there must be some people like myself, that is, who were interested in... who were venturesome and who were interested in getting into a new university at the beginning and contributing in ways that were undefined as well as those that were clear-cut. And it took a lot of doing, and I did get a number of people to come in. I don't remember all of them, but I do remember a couple who came, and I was lucky enough to be able to... interest Robert LaCashman, who was at Columbia University, Barnard College, and whom I had known as a graduate student, and who had combined a very sharp economic mind with a love for writing, which wasn't always the combination that economists had. And we were fortunate to get him to come, and he came in 1965 at the same time that John Toll started his tenure here. Now, to get back to the very beginning, in addition to looking for a chairperson, I had to recruit people because we were expanding the student bodies. If I'm not wrong on this, it seems to me that when I came to Stony Brook, this is before the 1963 academic year started, the student body was under 1,000, not many under 1,000.
I think you're right,
yeah.
Yes.
And with the new class in 1963, it just went over that 1,000 mark. And so with the expansion, which was a planned expansion, we needed more faculty members. And I was the third one in the department, and we were constantly recruiting. There were two things that we seemed to be doing throughout the academic year, and that was working on the budget and recruiting. Recruiting was a perennial operation, which was something that not all universities were lucky enough to have as a quality. But since we were expanding, it meant that we were recruiting people every year. It also meant, and we kept our fingers crossed, that mistakes that were made could often be overcome by the new personnel that came in. At any rate, I remember spending considerable time recruiting and getting some young, well-qualified people. But there, too, in the recruiting, there was the problem of the name of Stony Brook not being known. And therefore, we were constantly explaining, sketching the mission of the university.
Where did you do your recruiting? How far outside New York State did you go?
Well, we went all over the country, because I would be going to the meetings, the national meetings of the American Economic Association, and I would also be using the contacts we had in the universities that we came from. By we, I mean the members of our faculty, as well as colleagues in other departments, so that one person sticks out in my mind, and that was a young economist who was Korean in his background, and he didn't get his PhD from any of the universities in the metropolitan area. That was one thing that we were trying to avoid, not absolutely, but we were trying to get a catholicity of approaches and backgrounds.
A well-balanced pool from which to...
That's right, so that the first people that we did recruit were from outside the metropolitan area, and even some of them were outside this region. As a matter of fact, two of the young people I remember very well were James Cornells and Edward Van Roy. Edward Van Roy was born in the Netherlands, but he became an American citizen. He and Cornells came from the University of Texas, and they were very bright, and they were very, very much interested in being at a place like Stony Brook. So we did get people from all over the country, and we did begin to build a department. Though it wasn't until Robert LeCashman came that we were able to look for more senior people. And there, too, we got people like Egon Neuberger, who came from the universities outside the New York metropolitan area. And then we started to recruit people from the University of Indiana. When Ed Ames came, his contacts were there. And so, over time, we still maintain a balance in terms of where people came from. But obviously, people who had contacts with particular universities would use those contacts.
Where did Neuberger come from?
I don't remember. I think he got his PhD from Harvard, but I'm not certain. I mean, my memory may be a little off there. We started contacting people at Yale and at other of the Ivy League universities, as well as elsewhere. At any rate, by 1965, when Robert LeCashman came, we had a small cadre of junior faculty who gave promise of successful scholarly development in terms of research and writing, and also who had some commitment to teaching. That was my background. You see, I came from a college, and I had been teaching at this college, Queens College, which incidentally is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year, where there was a very strong emphasis on teaching, even though we had outstanding faculty in terms of research and publication. And I know that I was inspired by the teachers I had, who were excellent and who were also first-rate scholars.
Who was your president at Queens one time? Remember
Paul Clapper.
That's right. He was,
and he deserves a lot of the credit. He was the first president of Queens, and he was he therefore, as an educator, and I mean by that, he got his training at Teachers College and had been at City College and was the first president of Queens College, which was set up in 1937. I guess that's exactly 20 years before this institution was set up. 57, as I recall, was the year that you opened up in Oyster Bay. Well, Clapper was impressed. What was an impressive person. Of course, he was very fortunate. He was hiring faculty in a Depression decade. And so he got first-rate people who also had a commitment to teaching. And that's been a continuing tradition at that institution. And some of it carried over here, not just through me, but through other people who came from Queens College to teach at Stony Brook in different departments, in the language department, in English, and so forth and so on. At any rate, we were trying to emulate the best departments in terms of professional training, but also not forgetting that teaching was important.
Right.
Now, one of the things that I felt was very important was to get up a curriculum that would be basic, that all economics majors would take, and that would prepare them to be economists, whether they went on to advanced degrees or not. In other words, to apply economic analysis to the problems of the world. And it's interesting that in the contemporary world, people are economists without even knowing it, in a sense, because there are so many problems that call for economic analysis, because we're constantly making decisions with scarce means. And scarce means, but unlimited wants and needs. And so whether we're talking about time, whether we're talking about money, or whether we're talking about work, these analytic techniques are appropriate. At any rate, back in 1963, with that in mind, I developed a curriculum which was certainly not controversial in any way, but which I think included the basic elements of an economic education. At that time, remember, mathematical economics was just starting. There were three things that were important for me in a basic curriculum. One, economic theory or analysis. Two, economic history is sort of the application of theory to the real world. And three, the measurement factor. In other words, statistics and, of course, as we went on, mathematics and econometrics. So that those were the basic elements of the required courses that economics majors at Stony Brook would have to take in order to fulfill the major. And that, there was no problem. It was just that we got the curriculum through so that the students who were there and who were attracted to economics would be able to have a respectable education in this very important discipline. There was something else that was important to me. I don't know how it's fared, but it's important to understand what its context was, and that is the Economic Research Bureau, which, if you recall, was set up, I don't know whether it was 64 or when, somewhere around there, because it had to go through the whole process, and you had to approve it, and then it had to go to Albany. The rationale for that was that no matter how theoretical a department is, it ought to have an arm that could be used in empirical studies. Whether those studies were historical or contemporary in terms of business or in terms of taxation, whatever it might be, they should have that arm through which, one, the faculty themselves could engage in empirical research. Two, the community could commission empirical research that was important to them that some faculty member was interested in. In other words, it wouldn't be something that was imposed on us. And so the Bureau was set up, and I'm glad to see that it's still existing, but I have a soft spot in my heart for that, because I think that as important as theory is, in order for theory to be tightened, it needs to stand the test of
application,
being out in the light, and then when the empirics don't agree with the theory, then we have to recast the theory in a more understanding way. So that was an important, those were important elements in the curricular development of the department. Later on, of course, when we had more senior people and the department developed and there was a considerable number of majors, we went on to strengthen the curriculum by requiring mathematics and econometrics. Mm-hmm. And we recruited people who were proficient in those areas. Now, when Barbara Cashman came and started to recruit people who were a little more senior, the question arose, where was the department going? What was its objective in terms of its role in higher education, in the economics scene in higher education? And we discussed that a lot, and it was discussed also in our interviews with people. And we came up with a kind of economic answer which related other objectives of this university to the role that economics plays in the world. We decided that we should be strong in our comparative advantage, that is, in areas that would be related to the development of the university. First of all, of course, it was clear an absolute essential was that we have a very strong, firm founding in economic theory and analysis. No matter what your specialization is, that would have to be the bedrock on which it was built. We felt that we would have a comparative advantage in certain areas of public policy, and they would be medicine, medical economics, the economics of medicine, and the economics of education. These were fields that they've been with us a long time, but the development of the economics of these fields was in its infancy. There were well-known economists who studied medicine, that is, the economics of medicine, but there were no departments that were focused in that direction. So that basically we agreed, there was a consensus at the beginning. I don't know how it turned out, although I know that there are people here who are in those fields. We agreed, and the incoming recruits agreed that this was the direction to go, that we weren't going to compete with Harvard in terms of their bent, but we were going to develop in these areas that we were going to be more exposed to by the nature of this institution as it developed. And so we have now several economists who are known over the country and even in other parts of the world for the work that they do in the economics of education and the economics of medicine and healthcare, the broader concept, which was consistent with the kind of health science center we evolved at Stony Brook.
Did you give any emphasis to the economics of the island? This is light industry and the economics of the marine-based?
Well, that's something that some of which developed, the industry of the island and the planning and development of the island. As a matter of fact, early on, I don't know how early on, there was contact with Lee Koppelman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when Dieter Jacques took over as head of the Research Bureau, that was something that we developed, and we also had conferences and meetings with members of the community, the business community. I remember a contact with the Long Island Association, but I don't remember any of the details. But
yeah,
certainly we were open to, sensitive to the developments that were going on Long Island. Now sometimes you see there would be members of a department who are not interested in this. And that's okay, so long as the department itself does not hide from the world that it's really a part of, whether it denies it or not. And it was our hope that there would be continuing contact. And I understand now that you're going to have an industrial park developing east of the campus.
Yes, I think Jack Marburger is interested in the relations with industry here. And we have a chap who used to be at Grumman.
Along some of the lines that I've sketched, but I should point out now that my role in it changed, because in 1965, when John Toll came and when Bob LeCashman became chairman of the department, I was invited to join the administration as Bentley Glass's assistant, which seemed to me to be an exciting thing. Not that I wanted to give up being an economist, but I was still excited by the idea of being involved in the development of a first-rate new university. And so I went over to Bentley's office, and since Bentley was not here full-time in the beginning, I was very busy there, but I still maintained close contact with the department and through the chairman, and I continued to do my research on China, which I don't think I mentioned before except once. And to publish, and also to teach. While I didn't teach full-time, I did continue to teach, and I must say that was because I love teaching, and I still teach even though I'm retired.
What was your area of specialty in teaching?
Well, when I got my PhD, I was in economic history and industrial organization and labor institutions. My doctoral dissertation was on a depression, economic history of a depression, which meant using business cycle theory as well as economic history. And it was a depression of the 90s. As a matter of fact, some of my waggish friends have suggested that I ought to revise it now, that the 1990s are coming up. The title was The Depression of the 90s. It was after I finished my doctoral dissertation that I was sort of taking it easy and trying to decide which direction I was going to go in. That was back in 1954, thereabouts. And I was playing with the idea of refocusing my concentration toward economic systems, comparative economic systems. And I was even thinking about studying the Soviet economy, and I even started studying Russian, but I decided that I wasn't really that much interested. And I switched rather to the Chinese economy, because I felt, even though at that time it was not fashionable, that the Chinese would go a different way than the Russians, which they didn't do right away, but they did. And of course they're continuing to do that now. And so that in 1955 I started studying Chinese, and I started doing research on China, and I've been with it ever since. And as I don't know if I indicated it to you this earlier, I've been to China a number of times, and the last two times, in 1983 and 1987, I taught at a key university in Beijing, and I have considerable gratification to find now that my former students are among, since there are so few economically trained people in China, they're among those who are involved in the reforms that are going on, and they're working, some of them are working in the United States, but most of them are working in high offices in China, and I get to see them when I go back, or they get to see or talk to me when they come to the United States.
That must be very gratifying to you to see them. Have your influence on them reflected in what's going on. I hope the reform movement continues and isn't set back.
Well,
sabotaged.
So long as political stability can be maintained, I would expect that the reform movement will go on. some of the people there who were trained, incidentally, who studied with me, studied only with me their economics. And see, these are all people who had to study in English, because the English is the second language. There's a joke in China, and that is English is the first language that people learn beyond their own language. If they can't make it, then they study Russian. It's probably an exaggeration. At any rate, the young people in China are very strongly motivated and think that they're optimistic about what can happen to them and what can happen to their country.
There's a newness about it in some ways. What about the quality of students that came to you and that you found in the university?
The quality of students improved over time. You know, faculty members always complain about the quality of students, but I've been through that a long time, and I just know that the students at Stony Brook were good students. They became better. And, of course, once we got a full program with a graduate program appended to it, we were able to command excellent students from the whole market.
When did the graduate program begin?
Well, I don't remember the exact year, but I would say it must have been somewhere in the maybe the beginning 70s, but I don't have a firm recollection. But we were preparing for it, I remember, over a considerable period of time. And of course, you see, the graduate program was an essential if we were going to be able to recruit first-rate faculty. We had to have a timetable on that, and it got pushed, I'm sure, as rapidly as possible, because most of the best people will not go to a school unless there is a graduate program. The graduate students also started to change. They became more international once we were underway, and it was interesting.
Background or interest, or both?
No, by background. Interest developed along those lines. For example, we started to get a good number of Chinese students that had come from Taiwan and from Hong Kong, and eventually we got some from the mainland. And the interesting thing there was that the Chinese students were very good in math, whether they were male or female. Ironically, when I was in China the first time, I was amazed to find out that economics majors not only didn't study math, they didn't even study statistics. That's been changed, though, and now they do study both. The University of International Business and Economics in Beijing, where I had been, has a more advanced curriculum for students because it specializes in economic subjects and management, things of that sort. Anyway, to get back to my role in the department, as I said, I became Bentley Glass's assistant. That was 1965, and that continued till 1968. Then I was asked by John Toll and Bentley Glass to become acting provost of social and behavioral sciences, because they were attempting to set up a provostial system for the different divisions. It didn't get through at that time, but I was acting provost for a couple of years, including one year when I was on sabbatical leave. And then when I came back, that would have been, I went on sabbatical leave in 1969. I came back in 1970.
And the same year that I went on sabbatical.
Yeah. And then when I came back, I was asked to become assistant academic vice president, which I did. Bentley Glass was in his last year or two in that position because of the mandate.
He and I are the same age to the day.
That's right, and I'm exactly 15 years younger than the two of you.
Is that right?
January is the month that we were born in, all of us.
Yeah, January 17th.
Right. Which is a week, you were born a week, not after I was, but date, a week later, on January 10th. So I'm still supposedly young. I understand that Bentley is still around here.
Yes, he is. He hasn't moved.
Anyway, that was my... Then I was assistant academic vice president until 1974. And that meant that when Sidney Gelber became academic vice president, I was his assistant vice president, one of his assistant vice presidents. Then in 1974, I returned to my department, but actually, I got involved with the faculty development program that was financed partially by the American Historical Association, and Bill Taylor was the director of that. And then when Bill Taylor went on leave, I was the director for 1 year.
So what did that do, and what was its function?
Its function was to involve faculty in a variety of activities that aided them in their continuing development. And so we had a variety of activities. We had such things like team teaching, the use of video, workshops, joint operations with Farmingdale campus, as well as with some community college faculty, so that there was a sharing of problems, teaching problems, as well as curriculum problems. And this went on for a number of years. It was at the same time that the Federated Learning Communities was gestating. That much of that went back to this. I'm searching for a word. We did have a, I don't know if it was a 10-year or 20-year period in which we did a study of the university under Sid Gelber. And one of the themes that came out of the study was that there were some students where there was a mismatch between, these were undergraduate students, between their expectations for Stony Brook and the reality. And so it was felt that there ought to be alternative programs that would take care of students of this sort.
Would you call this institutional studies?
Yes, it was. As a matter of fact, what's his name?
Ray Manusco is.
Yeah, but then the fellow who came from Stanford, I know his name well, but I'm blocking it out. No, it was the short fellow with glasses, and who shared the room with, what's his name, the former president of the Albany campus.
Collins?
No, who came here after he left Albany.
Oh, you mean Joe Katz?
That's right, Joe Katz was the one, and then with him was later on.
Louis Benezet.
That's right, Louis Benezet. So, a lot of this was going on as we were soul-searching, so to speak, in this study that was commissioned by Sid Gelber. I think it came just before the Middle States Association did its periodic evaluation. And they were very much impressed with this study. Because the study, you know, it wasn't just a laudatory study. It identified some very important problems in undergraduate education. And especially in a campus that was trying to develop as a university center, there were often tensions between the undergraduate interests and the graduate interests. So,
I think we still have that.
Well, you're always going to have the tensions. The question is how those tensions get resolved.
Right.
And, of course, the temper of the times is different, and the fact that you don't have as many undergraduates coming into higher education proportionally as you used to means that at least some attention has to be given. So that was back in, we get back 1974 to 70. Six, I was involved in the AHA faculty development program. When I wasn't directing it, I was working with Bill Taylor and spending some of my time, which was released from my department for that. But I continued always to play a role in the economics department.
Is he still here, Taylor?
I think so. He lives in the city, but he's still here. Now, in 1976, I went on sabbatical leave, But before I left, I also had contact with the faculty Federated Learning Community program that was emerging. It had not started yet. It started in 1976. And Pat...
Pat Hill
was the one who helped to bring it to fruition and became its first director. Are we still on there?
Yeah, she's still going.
Okay.
Another 10 minutes.
And so at the same time as I was involved in the AHA program, we articulated with the emerging Federated Learning Community. And we shared notes and thoughts with Pat Hill. Before I left on sabbatical, Pat Hill asked me if when I came back I would be willing to be the first one after him to work in his program, the FLC. And I said, well, I would consider it. And we corresponded. And as a matter of fact, I started to do some of the spade work when I was on sabbatical, in addition to my own research on China. I did move around and spoke to some people at Sonoma State University that were involved in parallel activities. When I came back in 1977, I took on the role, which was a full-time role, of... Master Learner was the name. It always chokes in my throat because it's a little pretentious. At any rate, the reality was much more real than the pretension of the title. And ours was the second group. If you recall, this was a program in which a group of students, maybe between 30 and 40 students, would sign up to take a minor in an area which had a theme to it. It was interdisciplinary, or if you want to avoid controversy, transdisciplinary. Although part of our mission was to try to develop the concept of interdisciplinary teaching and learning. Now, the focus of our group was cities, utopias, and environments. And the students took in that program six courses in six different disciplines. One was in theater arts, one was in art history, one was in psychology, one was in philosophy, one was in, I'm not remembering all of them. One was in...
social science?
It must have been. Oh, history.
History.
I left out Phil Taylor in history, and then there was one other.
Anything in science?
Yes, science. Slobodkin. It was a biology course that was called Evolution. Ecology and Evolution. Now, as a master learner, I had to take all those courses and the exams and write the papers and all that was terrific for me. I mean, it was a re-education, and I was gratified that I was able to do well in science, and I enjoyed it all very much. But not only was I to take all the courses, but I was to do a critique of each of the faculty members at the end of the course. And it was a long critique. I don't remember how many pages. It might have been something like 20 pages. It was a confidential report. In all cases except one, however, the reports were made open. The one person did not want the report to be made open, and I refused to give the report away to the person because it was still my report. But I've honored the confidentiality of it. It's in my files somewhere. These reports were supposed to be useful to the faculty members. And I must say that I got quite an eye-opener on the way some of, remember, committed colleagues. These are committed colleagues, Because after all, persons who are not committed to teaching and to even looking with some critical eye at their own teaching, they wouldn't be in the program. Now, in addition to the six courses, and remember, this was over a period of a couple of years, but the six courses were taken three each semester. In addition to the six courses, there were three seminars. There was a faculty seminar, and I was a member of it. The six faculty members plus the master learner, plus I think Pat Hill was there too. Then we had a joint seminar, the students and the faculty. And then there was a student seminar, of which I was a member. I was a member of all three seminars. So I must say I was very busy. But it was exciting because one of the things that we did is the students, and I consider myself a student in this context, the students met at odd periods informally. We had a hangout, and we used to meet there, and my role, you see, was a very interesting one. I was to interpret the faculty to the students and the students to the faculty, as well as to assist in any way in the educational process. To try to explain, why was it that in one discipline you got certain principles which seemed to be in conflict with principles in another discipline? We would wrestle with that problem, and I must say it was one of the most exciting experiences I ever had. Now, I had early on had some commitment to interdisciplinary, or at least to multidisciplinary learning when I was an undergraduate, because I had been exposed to some of that at Queens College, seminars that cut across the disciplines.